Sheriff Williams reacts to the president's comments about how police should treat suspected criminals. The city of Jacksonville considers suing opiate manufacturers. And we'll tell you why the mayor wants to streamline the city's children's services. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. And live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app, listen to us there anytime, or on iTunes. We are streaming live on Facebook right now as well. And just ahead, a look at the biggest stories of the week with our Friday Roundtable. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, some laughs this weekend as local comedians get together to help mental health advocates stronger than stigma. Also, don't miss the live in-studio performance from the Apex Theater's production of Godspell, all of that ahead. But first, it's Friday and time to break down the biggest stories of the week as we welcome Tessa Duvall from the Florida Times-Union. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Regular contributor blogger Fred Matthews is here.
Good morning, Melissa.
WJCT's own reporter Ryan Bank.
Good morning.
And new to the panel, Lynn Jones of the Jacksonville Free Press.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good to have you all here with us. Lots to discuss this Friday. Everything from a potential lawsuit Jacksonville's considering against opiate manufacturers to the mayor's call for a new city alliance for kids. But our top story this Friday, Jacksonville Sheriff Mike Williams causing a stir as he reacts to the president's recent comments about police. Now, you might have noticed that President Trump in a recent speech said that some police departments, including Gainesville, Florida's, have been denounced for endorsing police brutality. Williams, who heads a department that's faced high-profile controversies of its own over use of force, said that the president may have been joking when he said in a New York speech the other day that police shouldn't be so nice to suspects. First, let's listen to the president.
I said, please don't be too nice. Like when you guys put somebody in the car and you're protecting their head, you know, the way you put their hand over. Like, don't hit their head and they've just killed somebody, don't hit their head. I said, you can take the hand away, okay?
Now, Sheriff Williams, after listening to the president, went on to say that statements like that, even if they're made in jest, can undermine the relationship between police and the communities they serve. Here's Williams speaking Wednesday.
I encourage people to look locally at what we do here, and I think our actions speak much louder than any comment out of anybody from D.C.
All right, so here's our question to callers as we kick off the roundtable. What do you think of the president's comments, and what do you think of the sheriff's reaction? Give us a call. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. You can weigh in on Facebook as well. We're streaming live there right now. Ryan Bank, let's begin with you. You covered this story in Sheriff Williams' comments. Sheriffs around the country have reacted to what the president said about how police treat suspected gang members, drug dealers, etc.
Well, Sheriff Williams' comments were far more middle of the road than maybe some other sheriffs around the country, particularly the public information officer for the Gainesville Police Department. He basically said that although he is certain or pretty sure that the president was making a joke, that this was an attempt at humor, that at the same time, even if a statement like this in jest does real damage to a police department's relationship to their community. And I think especially so in the kind of more aware social attitudes that we have about, you know, minorities and their run-ins with law enforcement, high profile police shootings, and even Jacksonville has more than a few of those in the last couple of years as well. So I think the sheriff probably just doesn't believe that this is really going to make his job or the jobs of his officers any easier.
Right, Fred Matthews, Lynn Jones, law enforcement has to build relationships in communities in order to catch suspected criminals. How does this complicate their efforts?
Well, it doesn't really complicate it that terribly much. It just is a bad PR move for them nationally. I mean, unfortunately, most of the police officers, the FOP, and all those endorsed this president. So I don't think they can be terribly surprised by anything that he would say on or off the cuff. The president was just merely making an observation that you can, from any glib comments you'd see on Law and Order any night that you watch it on television. So I don't think it's, the sheriff did the PR thing, which was say, no, we wouldn't do such a thing and we don't condone such a thing. But the other part of the out is this is who you endorsed. This is who most of the police unions in this country endorsed, including, I'm pretty sure, the one here in Duval County.
Isn't that what's so interesting about this, is that you often have people who are very pro-Trump who are also very pro-police, and now a little bit with these police departments coming out in opposition to this comment that Trump has made, some people don't know where their allegiance should fall anymore. I just think that's a really kind of interesting political thing that's happening as a fallout to all of this.
Lynn.
Well, at the same time, I mean, with the current climate between the police and the citizens, I think it happens anyway. I mean, depends on the cop, depends on the certain police officer. Some police officers may put your head in lightly and some may hit your head on the car. So basically, I think that that's Trump. That's what Trump does. He hasn't been in the police car. He doesn't know anything about the police. All he knows is get the thugs, basically.
And, you know, there's a reason for this type of protocol, by the way, that law enforcement, whether they're putting you in a police car or other, I mean, there are rules that law enforcement swears to follow when treating people, processing people through the system.
Yeah, and so
this is just one of them,
right? And so two things. The first thing, just kind of going off of Fred's comments in particular, Sheriff Williams was at some of these Donald Trump rallies and has received pushback and flack for it. Everybody knows what happened in Heming Park with the protesters and with the counter protester Gary Snow, who, you know, it was then discovered online took a picture with Sheriff Williams. So we understand that when it comes to specific comments made by Donald Trump, I think the Gainesville public information officer said it best when he said, our job, once the handcuffs are on, are to deliver this person to the justice system, not to deliver justice. That their job is merely to transport somebody as humanely as possible. Now, obviously, there have been well-documented issues with police departments around the country, and we can all think of flashpoints like Ferguson and others. But when it comes to protocol, there's a reason, like you said, why these rules exist. It protects not only the suspect, but
the officer.
But the officers, yeah. Right, exactly.
What would you say then, Fred, to criticisms of the comment the president made that he seemed to be endorsing or encouraging police brutality?
Well, I mean, they would tend to be fairly well-founded based upon, again, his experiences, pretty much what Lynn was saying. We're talking about someone who does not have a legal background. We're talking about someone who has never had any experience getting arrested in a police car. Nobody in his family would ever do that. And if they did, they'd be out and bail in about 2 seconds. We're talking about someone who does not have the standard, the normal experiences. It almost harkens back to, I remember Bush 1, that moment when he went to a grocery store and they had the scanning machines, and he thought it was such a marvelous thing. He had never been in a grocery store to shop.
He later said that was taken out of context, and he really did understand the scanner. But the narrative was that, oh, you know, he's too well off to even go shopping for his own groceries.
And that's what we're dealing with here, is that a president who doesn't have normal experiences that you and I and millions of Americans have on a day-to-day basis, and certainly no experience with being handcuffed or being pulled over by police because he doesn't drive.
No doubt about it. That's the story right there, is because he has not had that experience. And you have individuals every day that go through this experience. You have individuals who, as I was saying, it's the cop. The cop, the particular cop that's arresting you, can still do damage to you mentally and spiritually and not treat you as a citizen. So I think that's what the problem is.
And the thing is that the police officers know the protocol.
Yes.
And they know that they're not supposed to do that. To have someone to stand up, again, the leader of the free world to stand up and make glib comments like that just to curry favor, because he was standing in front of police officers, just to curry favor.
Who clapped, by the way.
Okay.
Exactly. They did.
Just,
now,
yes. Yeah, to but, curry favor yes. with them. I mean, it just
all right,
look
but
right.
Going beyond the reaction he got from the police, mm-hmm. let's talk about who else the comments were intended to. Trump supporters who, they frankly have the same attitude. They like that attitude toward suspected criminals, and they don't see the argument that you need to necessarily protect the person's head if you're putting them into a cruiser.
Absolutely. I mean, and that riled up his base. I mean, it did what he intended to with that. And I mean, look, I don't think that there's anything that Trump can say that will surprise us anymore. I mean, let's think back to his rallies in regards to throwing the protesters out. If you beat up someone, I'll pay your legal fees. I mean, this is just someone who makes these off-the-cuff comments and isn't prepared to deal with the fallout from them. So, I mean, I think he thought, if anything, that, you know, saying this to police officers was supporting them, but really it's just kind of in line with all the past comments that
he's
made.
And let's go to your calls as we discuss the top stories of the week. What are your thoughts about President Trump's comments and the local sheriff's reactions around Florida? 549-2937. Give us a call. Rod is in St. Augustine. Hey, Rod, good morning. Go ahead and turn your radio down, Rod. Go ahead. Okay, Rod, are you there? Okay. Listen, everybody who's listening and wanting to call in, you got to turn your radio down when we put you on the air. Okay, we'll go back to him in just a minute. Also this week, the city of Jacksonville is considering filing a lawsuit against opiate manufacturers. I always have trouble saying that word. Councilman Bill Gulliford says pharmaceutical companies are complicit in Northeast Florida's opiate addiction epidemic. Now, at Gulliford's invitation, attorney Ailish Baig outlined the potential lawsuit on Thursday to local officials. Take a listen.
The case would be alleging that the manufacturers engaged in deceptive marketing, that they violated Florida's Unfair and Deceptive Trade Practices Act, which prohibits unfair methods of competition, and that the wholesalers failed to report vicious sales as they're required to do by federal and state law.
Okay, now this attorney, her firm is also representing the Florida cities of Delray Beach and Palm Beach County. Potentially, this could be a class action in Florida taking on the opiate manufacturers, not unlike the way states banded together and went after big tobacco. Ryan Bank, what do our legal analysts say? I know you've been looking into this. Can a lawsuit like this take hold? Can it have some teeth?
Well, you know, first of all, it doesn't actually have to go to court. I think the point of this lawsuit and lawsuits like this is to get a settlement from these companies. And they have put together this law firm has put together quite a blueprint here for how you can justify such a settlement. Basically, they're saying, listen, go to any doctor's office. Look at how many pens they have from all of these pharmaceutical companies. Look at how much they're pushed to prescribe this medication. They're essentially, you know, we've talked a lot about over-prescribing of opioid medications, and people have put that blame sometimes on doctors, saying that they're too easy for them to just write a prescription and give it to their patients. But what this lawsuit would say is the reason why is because they're being pressured and pushed by these pharmaceutical companies to do this. And on the other hand, they're saying that these companies knew very well that it was a potentially dangerous medication, or that it was a potentially a very I'm not sure what the word is, but I'll come back to it. But they're basically saying that they knew that this medication had a potential for a high addiction rate and decided to make commercials and advertisements that made it look safer than what it was.
And just looking at the numbers, it's a god-awful problem. 700 opiate overdose deaths this year in the city, according to Councilman Bill Gulliford. That compares to about 120 homicides. Duval County has one of the worst rates in the state for babies born addicted to opiates, and we are already looking at a $1.5 million pilot program to treat addicts in Duval County. This would, if this lawsuit is successful, Tessa, Fred, and Lynn, the earnings could go to treat more people in the throes of addiction, potentially.
Well, at the same time, how many people actually want to be cured or go to a rehab center? I mean, this is, the pill mills have been around for many years, so, and they're still just about on every corner. So the pharmaceutical companies are making money hand over fist, and I think they'll continue to make money. I don't think this class action suit really will do anything to...
Well, but let me ask you, though. Look at the tobacco, the landmark tobacco settlements as a precedent that we could potentially look to. And some local attorneys were involved in those landmark cases that delivered hundreds of millions of dollars to people who had smoking-related illnesses. Do you think there's even a chance for something like this to be done again?
At this point, I really don't know. I mean, because you go to the doctor, you need a prescription. Everywhere you have to get a prescription. So I really don't think that this will do anything. I mean, it may relieve and get some checks on the table, if anything, but I don't think that it will relieve anything in the community. People are hooked, and they're hooked bad.
Tessa?
Well, checks can pay for treatment, and that's an important thing to point out here.
And prevention.
And prevention, absolutely. And I came across some statistics earlier this week that 162 million fewer opioid pills were dispensed to Ohio patients in 2016 than in 2012, but yet deaths were still going up during that time frame when pills were becoming less available. So yes, people are hooked, but there's treatment. There is treatment available for this, but oftentimes it's expensive. It's hard to get into. You don't know where to find it. If the money could make those sorts of things available, perhaps that could move the needle.
And what the experts in addiction recovery will say, Fred, people go through 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 attempts at getting clean sometimes before they can finally get... This is such a severely addictive drug. Well, and oftentimes when they come out of rehab is when they're at the highest risk because they've been off the medication for a while. And so if they relapse and take it again, their system has been cleaned of it. So they're more susceptible to an overdose right after they come out of rehab and they're tempted to try it again. They're seeing this over and over again all over town.
Well, it's a lot of ifs involved in this, and you're right. I mean, this harkens back to the lawsuits against Big Tobacco, which was a legal drug. It harkens against, I don't think we've sued a Big Alcohol. It's a legal drug.
We tried prohibition, but that didn't work out so well.
we made it illegal, and then 10 years later we had to come back. I think they're in the same boat here. So yes, if the lawsuits yield some money that can be put into the kind of advertising campaign that they've been trying with tobacco over the last 10 years, particularly here in Florida, maybe there'll be some results. But again, this goes also back to our healthcare system in this country. Folks who are addicted to these drugs, who've gone through all of their money, don't have anywhere to turn to, their families don't, to get them into treatment on a regular basis. We as a country don't believe in helping people who have less. We don't believe in a payer system that would get people into treatment so that they can get off of the problems, the addictions that they have. And until we confront that issue, we're going to have this kind of... After all, they're taking the pain pills usually because they start off with a back problem or a knee problem or something like that. Athletes are... We have one local athlete that was on that not too long ago and found out that he was on a form of painkillers to take care of it. And he became addicted to it.
And with addiction, it's important to note that we treat this like a moral failing. We don't treat it like a disease. We treat it like you weren't strong enough. You are just kind of this low-life addict. I mean, we really don't think about this the way that we would even other mental illnesses or a physical ailment. You weren't strong enough to say no.
To resist, yeah.
And so you get what's coming to you. And that's
Lynn,
what
Yeah, Lynn.
Well, at the same time, and when we're talking about big business, we're talking about smoking. We're still smoking. We're talking about alcohol. We still drink. We're talking about opiates. We still take pills. I mean, we can take on big business all we can, but at the same time, these things will still be flowing through the community. They'll still be flowing through the parties that we attend. So it's up to the individual to know what they can do and what they can take as far as these pills are concerned. I mean, you know you're an addict.
If you start that? What if you're prescribed something legally for, say, after a back operation or something like that? You have a genetic susceptibility to this type of medication. Maybe you could get it from having some wisdom teeth taken out. You have a genetic susceptibility to this, and before you know it, recovery at specialists see this all the time. They start with some pain medication legally and ethically prescribed. Then they become hooked, and they're seeking out street heroin and fentanyl.
Well, I also want to kind of piggyback off that point that Lynn was making, because the fact of the matter is, you can say, yes, people are still drinking. Yes, people are still smoking, but at what rate? Mm-hmm. How many people are actually still smoking? I mean, that number has decreased phenomenally, I mean, exponentially in the last decade alone. Same thing with drinking. How many deaths do we actually see from drunk driving? Well, we still see deaths from drunk driving. It's not a great thing. Obviously, we want to prevent as many of them as we can, but those have dropped significantly since we raised the alcohol age to 21. So I take that point, but it's not an individual issue necessarily. And it's not that regulations or settlements or lawsuits or things like that can't help, assuade the problem.
All right, let's go to a lot of calls on this as we talk about local officials considering a lawsuit, and it could be a class action lawsuit in Florida against opiate manufacturers. Carly is in Nassau County right now. Hey, Carly, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Hello?
Go ahead.
I'm a psychiatrist in Fernandina Beach, and I have a couple comments about the opioid epidemic. First, as a physician, I to a great extent blame physicians for over-prescribing the opioids quite frequently, much more than what is actually necessary to treat a given indication is prescribed, and then by the time a person is, you know, finished with the original condition, they run into withdrawal symptoms and difficulty getting off the medication to begin with. Another comment regarding the comparison with alcohol or cigarettes is that in the case of the opioid, you have insurance companies paying the vast majority of the bill for people to go out and get these drugs. So that kind of puts a little incentive or makes that path a little easier for those who otherwise may not have the resources. And then they are sold on the street, and this is adding not only in the overall mortality and the morbidity of the disease of opioid addiction, but that the insurance companies are paying for these drugs is adding to the overall cost of healthcare in this country, both on treating the disease, but also in the diversion of these drugs.
Yeah.
So I tend to think doctors bear the responsibility for their prescriptions and to be aware of the problems and to be much more much more discriminating about how they write these prescriptions. And in my experience, it's usually not all doctors, but there are, you know, always a few that tend to be far too unscrupulous with their prescribing patterns.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Carly. I appreciate that. Let's go to Jason on the West Side. Hey, Jason. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to share a quick comment and really to address the issue of the way that Big Pharma really lobbies in our state capitol. You know, we just got medical marijuana passed, and recently when I was in Colorado, I watched a young man, probably 14, 13 years old, with some very clear neurological disorders, and he had a jar of edible marijuanas, or what I can only assume to be marijuana candies, and it broke my heart, because you have people who could be helped, for instance, there are other drugs, there are other options that are not addictive like the opioids, and yet time and time again, we've got Big Pharma pushing down on the state capital. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for that, Jason. Okay, we're going to have to move on and talk about a few other stories making headlines from the week. If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. The number to join the show, 549-2937. Well, On Wednesday, Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry said he wants to consolidate the city's two major child welfare programs to better focus on those who are most in need. Now, Curry wants to create what he calls the Kids Hope Alliance. It would combine the crime-fighting initiative Jacksonville Journey and the child welfare entity, the Jacksonville Children's Commission. Both of these groups do everything from juvenile justice intervention to free and reduced lunch, summer camps, after-school programs, and more. The mayor wants to phase them both out over the next 6 to 9 months and create a new alliance looking at solutions to help better support children and get rid of programs he says are not really working as well as they should. Tessa Duval, is this something that is a government streamlining measure, or is it something that's you think will be more strategically wise in terms of addressing issues affecting children in this community?
Well, I think it's important to know that the Journey and the Children's Commission were each established at different times in Jacksonville's history.
That's right.
To respond to different situations. The Children's Commission came about under Mayor Ed Austin in the early 90s. He originally wanted to pass a tax that would help support programs that the JCC offers. Other cities in Florida, like Miami, for example, have a tax for those programs. And then the Journey came about in, I believe, 2007, I want to say, under Mayor Payton as a crime initiative
when the murder rate just spiked. Yeah.
Right. And so over time, there is some overlap. They both do summer camp and after school programming. But, you know, the Journey is involved in civil citations and juvenile justice and ex-offender reentry. The JCC does in school mental health initiatives. So while there is some overlap, I think it would be unfair to what both organizations were created as and were doing to say that they were duplicating each other. They were approaching things from a different way. Now, is streamlining everything that works for children under one roof a good idea? I mean, I guess we'll find out. But this thought that this is somehow dramatically different. It's still ultimately, it sounds like most of the same services will be provided. What Mayor Curry has referred to as feel-good programs, I don't know what he considers those to be. But essentially, it's still the same budget, and we'll still be doing most of the same things for children.
Yeah,
here.
The budget of about $36 million, Fred.
Well, it's been a bee in the mayor's bonnet since he got into office, because he's got two different entities pulling on for money, and he's got these neighborhood children's issues hitting him in the face all the time. And most recently, the drownings that have taken place, the shootings that have taken place, the number of children that are going to schools where they're not going home to no parents at home. So he's had a lot of issues that are hitting him in the face, but he's got these two budget matters, these two entities that are still pulling off the same set of tax dollars and aren't really raising any. The past mayor, as you mentioned, was unsuccessful in getting a tax district allocated here in Duval County specifically for the Children's Commission. I don't think the mayor's necessarily proposing that.
He's not. He's against it.
Yeah. So in terms, yeah, he would be. You know,
yeah.
You know, more taxes. But so this is probably the best choice, is to just consolidate that together, get the two boards to agree, and let's go down a path that we know that one entity serving all the kids we can.
Lynn.
Well, that's a lot of money, $36 million. I mean, I have to agree with Mayor Curry on this, putting these two programs together. But let's see some results here, like you said. Let's see some evidence-based, as it says, solutions on these programs. I mean, we keep funding money and money and money and putting in all of these programs, but it's the same results all the time. Can we see what's really going to be the bottom line in these programs, helping these children to get them to the next level? So I agree. Again, I agree with Mayor Curry. Yes.
And when the mayor says, Ryan, that he's going to scrap programs that aren't working and build up those that are, we still don't know yet which initiatives might go on the junk heap and which ones might not.
Yeah, to Tessa's point, we have absolutely at this point no idea which programs he favors, which ones he doesn't. What we do know is that what he said during that press conference, which is essentially he wants to more closely track these kids that go through these programs. And he wants to really look at the data you know, for what programs have been working, to decide what programs have been working and which ones haven't. I think an interesting thing will be to see how many staff members from each individual organization actually continue working under this new umbrella.
Right.
Because we are looking at consolidation and people tend to lose their jobs.
That's right. There could be some job loss in this. Tessa.
It's possible, yes. So I do want to bring up something that, as someone who goes to JCC board meetings pretty regularly, I still want answers to. So at the end of last year, the mayor announced that he would like an audit of the Jacksonville Children's Commission programs. The whole point being he probably wasn't very happy with what he was seeing with JCC at the time. So now the reforms have been announced, and we still haven't seen the audit. I want to know what the audit said. I've been asking for it. So how are we changing things before we've seen the results of this audit? That's just a question that I still would like answered.
Well, I'm sure it's one you will keep asking until you get the answer. One of the things
obviously that should have come out of this from both of them is that we should have gotten an annual report, which we have not seen. I'm sure it's here somewhere, which would include the numbers. And that's hopefully one of the things that we will have laid out from this new entity. An audit, just like any other nonprofit, and an annual report that tells us bit by bit, by point, what you did the last year.
Yep. All right. Well, speaking of programs helping kids, did you hear about this? This week, federal judge Brian Davis reached out to local officials to try to support the nationally recognized EVAC program at Lee High School. Controversy had been swirling for weeks with rumors that the school district was going to eliminate this program despite its national laurels. At Tuesday's school board meeting, interim superintendent Patricia Willis told the audience neither the district or the school, Lee, have canceled EVAC. Now, EVAC is simply CAVE spelled backwards, and it's a program helping at-risk young men, looking at everything from juvenile justice advocacy to other life experiences that these young students have. It has received national honors, and they had been looking at expanding it to other schools. So what's the fate of EVAC?
Well, right now it's still kind of up in the air. There's a lot of finger-pointing going on right now, a lot of blame. There's a lot of very careful word choice out there about what's happening. But essentially, last week, the teacher, Ms. Donofrio, said on Facebook that the class won't be continuing. Now, the district is saying that they were shocked by this Facebook post, that they didn't know what was coming. I think that we're still trying to figure out what is actually happening with this, because I don't think that there's really any reason that Ms. Donofrio would just throw her hands up and not continue this. So there's something going on that we are all still obviously trying to figure out. But people are really passionate about this class. Mm-hmm. I mean, for a federal judge to step in and tell the mayor and the state attorney
and the sheriff,
call me, we need to talk.
Yeah.
That tells you that this is something that's really impactful.
Yeah.
So where's the funding? Where's the funding coming from for this
program? It was just a class.
I think it was just a high school class. But okay. but it had been so successful that it had received national awards. They were, the last time I had heard about it, they were talking about spinning it off to other schools.
Yes. One of at the heart of this, obviously, is the teacher, Mr. Donofrio. And there are some things, a lot being left unsaid there at Lee High School. One of the things we've learned about these programs that start with the teacher's idea and are successful in that particular school where the kids love it. And again, we've got persons who are looking to graduate under this program, is that there's an issue between the teacher and the principal and the vice principal at that school. And they have not been able to solve it. It probably has a little bit to do with ownership, has to do with direction of the program. And as it grows out of Lee, the direction is going to change a bit. And what's at the crux here. Now, for some reason, I'm sure they must have known Judge Davis. So he has a little more insight that encouraged him to write this letter. Because anybody who knows Judge Davis knows that he's one of the few federal judges that you can actually meet on the beach, and he's walking down there with a cigar enjoying himself. But you know, there's more to this story, and it's based right there at Lee High School between that teacher and the principal and the vice principals. That's where the problem is.
Maybe a backstory there.
Yeah, I just want to point out there is a power dynamic at play, that it's really easy for the superintendent and the principal to make public statements about the teacher said this and the teacher said that. But the teacher is in no way has the power to come out and point fingers back at the principal and the superintendent. So I want to just encourage people.
All she has
things
is her
about
Facebook
this.
Page.
And she wants to keep her job, I'm assuming.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure she does. Well, finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. Maybe Judge Davis saw this guy on the beach, Fred, because only in Florida are sugar daddies ordered off the beach. Yes, a 73-year-old Florida man banned from a Florida beach after parents complained he was handing out business cards that read, "Sugar Daddy Seeking His Sugar Baby."
Oh, boy.
Authorities say Richard Basabara has to stay off the beach and even the walkovers for 6 months for violating an ordinance that prohibits soliciting on the sand.
You can't. That's an inference. That's not a solicitation.
Basabara tells the Daytona Beach News Journal he's devastated by this news. It's an overreaction, he says. But a 16-year-old girl told police that Basabara handed her 18-year-old friend a card Saturday that featured a picture of a young woman sitting on an older man's lap. It also included an email address.
Mind the age gap, folks.
Only in Florida.
Only in Florida does a man receive life behind bars because he killed his girlfriend after she yelled out another man's name during sex.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, on Thursday, a judge sentenced 26-year-old Fidel Lopez to life in prison with no chance of parole. Investigators said Lopez went insane when his girlfriend, 31-year-old Maria Nemeth, called him by her ex-husband's name during an intimate moment. After Maria's cries of passion, Lopez admitted to murdering and even disemboweling his girlfriend. It's pretty awful story.
That was like a blues song.
Finally, only in Florida do angry retired guys shoot at AT&T workers to make them remove their trucks from their property. Police in Hialeah say retired Miami-Dade firefighter 64-year-old Jorge Jove got very upset that the AT&T utility guys were working on lines in front of his house. He told them to move, and they said they were almost done with repairs, but that didn't satisfy Jove because cell phone video captured the gun-toting homeowner as he circled the AT&T trucks and opened fire, shooting out their truck tires, apparently not realizing that doing that would prevent them from leaving his property, which is what he wanted in the first place.
Well, he doesn't have a landline. He
doesn't
know. As
a Miamian, I can tell you right now, the only difference between this story and any other day in Hialeah is that this was on video.
I'm sure you're right, and that'll get us started for the weekend. Thank you, Lynn Jones, Ryan Bank, Tessa Duval, and Fred Matthews. Everyone, enjoy your weekend, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Miss Melissa.
And we'll be right back.
I saw that video.
There are a lot of people in the city of New York. A lot of people means a lot of trash, and getting rid of that trash has a price.
There's nothing inexpensive about moving waste in the city of New York. It costs us about $300 million a year for our final disposal.
I'm Kai Rizdal. The cost of garbage day. Next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele. We have a good show coming up for you this weekend on A Prairie Home Companion, if I do say so myself, with music from The Shins and Miss Regina Spektor, plus the Royal Academy of Radio Actors will be there. That's Tim Russell, Serena Brooke, and Mr. Fred Newman. Our first call radio players, there'll be a new song of the week, and much, much more. Hope you'll join us.
Saturday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Call Calling all educators. WJCT and Community First Credit Union are proud to present the 5th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire. Saturday, September 16th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. Tickets are $30. Tickets purchased for the 2016 event will be honored. Share ideas with colleagues. Learn new ways to engage students and empower yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets now. WJCT.org/teach.
Folk, blues, jazz, R&B, country, western, Americana. It's all acoustic and it's all in one place. And that one place is String Theory. And you can hear String Theory Friday nights at 11 p.m. only on 89.9 WJCT. String Theory, the very best of modern acoustic music. This and every Friday night at 11 p.m. on WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's your chance to get out this weekend, have some laughs with local comedians, and also support the local group Stronger Than Stigma. The next edition of Solid Laugh Advice is set for this Sunday at Nighthawks, and it supports mental health efforts here on the First Coast. Gabrielle Maggett is executive director of Stronger Than Stigma. She joins us now along with local comedian Nick Davis. Hey, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, this is great. I listen every day, so it's nice to be on the other side.
Oh, very good. Yeah. Now, here you are in Studio 5. Let's start with you. You organized this event, Nick, correct?
Correct. I'm a local comic here, and definitely want to plug the Jacksonville comedy scene. It's an amazing scene full of tremendous comics. But so I was putting together the show, and I think a lot of, I don't want to speak for all comics, but a lot of us do kind of have mental health issues. because we think that...
The tears of a clown, you mean? Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
For some reason, we think getting up in front of random people is therapy. So so I thought maybe I could do something to give back. And so I partnered with Gabrielle on doing this show. And it's comedians giving life advice, but we're not licensed. So I highly recommend not taking it.
But laughing along the way. And this supports Stronger Than Stigma. Gabrielle, tell us about Stronger Than Stigma.
Yes. So it's a nonprofit organization, a 501c3, that a couple of my college friends and I started back when we were students at the University of Florida. And it was all about breaking down the barriers that keep people from reaching out for help. So it's specifically targeted towards millennials, because I truly believe that our generation will be the ones to finally get rid of this terrible stigma and help everybody feel comfortable in their own skin and know that reaching out for help is not a weakness, it's a strength.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you're going to use humor to do this. What are some of the acts going to feature?
Well, we have 8 comics, and it's all stand-up. And then we have another comic that may do a song, may do a little musical interlude. So it's going to be fun. Nighthawks is a great venue for stand-up, and I think a lot of people enjoy it, and there is alcohol, so that's always a good thing as well. So.
And yeah, as the night goes on, probably much more of it. And with local comics Chris Buck, Trevor Johnson, Jenny Lee, McGalliard, Spencer Ruizzo, Mike Atchison, Dylan Darbo, Herman Nasworth, and Alex Gasparini, and Robert Allen Hall.
That's correct.
All right. And so this is Sunday night at Nighthawks. How can people get their tickets?
Just show up.
Yeah, tickets at the door.
Yeah, tickets at the door.
7 o'clock?
7 o'clock.
All right. It's Stronger Than Stigma's 2nd annual Solid Laugh Advice, Sunday night at Nighthawks, supporting mental health efforts here on the First Coast. Come out, have some laughs, and meet Nick Davis and other local comedians here on the First Coast. Gabrielle Maggett and Nick, thanks for being with us. Hope you all have a great time.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back.
At this time of the year, we're used to plenty of heat.
Jim. Jim. Jim.
What the United States has been about.
Jim.
Let's shed some light on another bumpy week here in Washington. Also, a look at the latest jobs report and more strong numbers on the economy. The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Appointment with Public Radio's favorite family doc on the next Zorba Fest Around Your Health. It'll be a jam-packed hour on healthy living, including this recipe for
summer squash with basil and garlic.
We always have a great time. So will you on Zorba Fest Around Your Health from PRI Public Radio International.
Sundays at 5 on 89.9 WJCT.
Calling all educators. WJCT and Community First Credit Union are proud to present the 5th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire. Saturday, September 16th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. Tickets are $30. Tickets purchased for the 2016 event will be honored. Share ideas with colleagues. Learn new ways to engage students and empower yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets now. WJCT.org/teach.
Welcome back. Finally this hour, it's the beloved Broadway classic that puts a contemporary spin on the Gospel of St. Matthew's. The Apex Theater Studio is presenting Godspell this weekend, live on stage at the Pontevedra Concert Hall tonight and Saturday. Joshua K.A. Johnson, a rising freshman at the prestigious Cincinnati Conservatory of Music, is in the role of Jesus. He joins us now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also here, director Ian Mayers. Good to see you.
T-G-I-F.
That's right. Okay, so this is a show that people have known and loved for many years.
Oh, indeed. Full of earworms, right?
Yeah, we all grew up hearing these songs.
We set ours in a contemporary urban classroom, and so our Jesus is a young substitute teacher who's struggling to convert his disciples, who are a bunch of unruly kids.
Oh, interesting.
We were looking for a way for the audience, especially young artists, to connect to the work. And so far, it's proved very successful. This is our fourth summer doing
it. So you kind of gave it almost a Hamilton-type spin.
It's true. We even have a little bit of a rap in there,
yes.
Right? There's
hip-hop,
a rap in
a
Jesus.
Hip-hop Godspell? No way.
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit. So Joshua, you're going to be a freshman at the Cincinnati Conservatory of Music. I know that school very well. It's a really great place.
It's such an amazing school. Such a great program. Such great training. And so many great people.
Have you ever played Jesus Christ before?
I have not. This is a first.
Pretty exciting.
Yes, it is.
And we've had two graduates from Cincinnati, from Jacksonville, Liz Pierce.
Yes.
And Daniel, both ended up on Broadway. So the bar has been set for Joshua.
Now, in this production, you're supported by young artists from five area high schools, Douglas Anderson, Atlantic Coast, and Stanton.
Yes.
So lots of young local talent on the
course.
Stage.
Of course. I also graduated from Douglas Anderson, and I've worked with many of the other students as well. And it's so great to be back with them and do this final show before I leave for college.
Very exciting. Now, we're in for a treat because you're going to sing for us. What's the number?
The number is Beautiful City. It is the opening of Act Two. It is when Jesus comes in and sees the classroom is all in distress, and he is building up the courage to stay and to finish his lessons.
Here he is, Joshua K.A. Johnson.
And rubble out of the smoke, out of our night of struggle, can we see a ray of hope? One pale thin ray reaching for the day. We can build a beautiful city. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. We can build a beautiful city. Not a city of angels, but we can build a city of men. We may not reach the ending, but we can start slowly but truly mending brick by brick, heart by heart. Now, maybe now we start learning how we can build a beautiful city. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. We can build a beautiful city, not a city of angels, but we can build a city of men. When your trust is all but shattered, when your faith is all but killed, you can give up, bitter and battered, or you can slowly start to build a beautiful city. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. We can build a beautiful city, not a city of angels, but finally a city of men, a city of men.
Hey, beautiful. Oh, what an amazing voice you
have. Thank you so much.
He's Joshua K.A. Johnson, star of Godspell. It's live on stage Friday and Saturday at Pontevedra Concert Hall, produced by Apex Theater Studios. Director Ian Mayers, it's going to be a great show.
Yes, indeed. EPVConcertHall.com for tickets.
Get your tickets now. That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. We always value your feedback. Send emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And never miss a show. Download the WJCT app to listen anytime. Next on 1A, the Friday News Roundup. And don't miss our rebroadcast of this show tonight at 8 p.m. I'm Melissa Ross, and this has been First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again Monday at 9 a.m. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.